Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled, We Need to Talk About Bet and Joan, Writing About Famous Figures. Elizabeth I and Joan of Arc have been the subjects of countless books, engendering myth, obsession, and various interpretations of their lives. Linda Fennell asks Jane Caro and Ali Alizadeh why they chose to investigate the stories of these famous women and how they bring fresh perspectives to their histories.
The first question that comes to mind for each of you is why Jeanne, why Elizabeth, and what motivated you to write about her? So, Ali, shall we start with you? Because you've had a long relationship with Jeanne d'Arc in different forms, including poetry, I believe.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of hard to be able to pin it down because it was such a long time ago and I was a child. And I think the initial interest that one takes is kind of difficult. It's mysterious. It's impossible to fully describe. You know, it's not based on immediate needs. Like you can say I'm thirsty, I drink water, but whatever attracts me to a historical figure as a child doesn't have that immediate sort of question of need. I think for whatever reason I became interested, but I remain interested. I think that's the big difference between, you know, I mean, I don't know, taking a sort of a fancy and then forgetting about it and then remaining interested. And I think what really retained that interest for me was the fact that she is such a global, universal figure. I encountered her in my place of birth. But then I moved to Australia, and there she is again. I was looking for a topic to do for my PhD in creative writing, of all things. And I was sort of toying about writing something about her because I've always been interested. But I thought, well, who cares? I mean, I'm trying to make it in Australia as a contemporary Australian writer, the last thing people want. And we're in the age of identity politics, so who would even want to publish, let alone buy a book about a medieval French Catholic woman written by someone like me. So I came to Melbourne and there's a massive statue. Well, I decided to go to the State Library of Victoria and there's a massive statue of her outside. And I thought, well, this is meant to be. So this is a fascinating thing. And what has also sustained my interest has been that for research and so on, I've traveled to France a number of times over the years and she has made a genuine revival over there in a way that is not all kind of frightening and linked with some sort of a national identitarian project, which is there. Mm-hmm. But also there's, you know, renewed scholarly and cultural interest, which I find quite interesting as well.
So do you see her as a symbol of French nationalism or as a spiritual figure or as a combination?
I don't personally, she has been used as a figure of French nationalism, clearly, especially from late 19th century onwards. She's associated with the far right. There's a group called Action Française, where a monarchist extreme right group. They use her as a mascot. She's loved by the Vichy government. More recently, the Front National of Le Pen and others have used her. Some might say effectively, some might say not so effectively. People are kind of fed up with the way that they, you know, every time Marine Le Pen gets up in front of a massive poster of Jeanne, well, people get a bit, they know this is rubbish. But at the same time, you know, she has also been used for other sort of national projects. I do think she was a nationalist, even though at the time she comes about, the nation state as such doesn't exist. But she's clearly a patriot. And I think that in terms of the language of nationalism scholarship, we might say she's a civic nationalist. She clearly believes in the centralized government where the king or the ruler or the sovereign looks after their peasants and so on. There's a sort of a contract between the ordinary people and the ruler. That's a very modern idea. That's a social contract theory. So that's one of the things that is exciting about her is that she would be propagating a politics that is way ahead of its time. And in fact, I think she plays a part in creating what will become eventually the first modern nation state, which is France. But that's a long time later.
Jane, for you, was your obsession with Elizabeth one of long standing?
Yes. But I also know very clearly why, as a child, I became obsessed with Elizabeth first. And it was because back when I was born in 1957, so I was a child basically in the early 60s, beginning to read and look at the world and wonder, you know, I was looking, like all children do, for role models, for heroes. And for girls then, and those there were, like Jeanne d'Arc, came to horrible ends. You know, they were all, they had to pay for their independence and their impact on the world, and they had to pay horribly. And then I came across this real kind of conundrum, this strange figure in history who was a woman, a queen, a virgin, and before we get into that, she was a virgin. And so we all know. And if you want to know how I know that, you can ask me later. But and she was a virgin. She never married. And she wielded power, and she was regarded, look, within the limits of her time and what wielding power at that time actually meant, to have done so well. She was regarded as a fearsome intellect. Nobody ever calls women geniuses. But if they had, they might have called her one. So she was this figure that really stood out. And she wasn't beautiful. And she wasn't, yes, she had flirtations and all that kind of thing, but it wasn't her sexuality that made her impressive. It was her ability, her character, her strength, her common sense, and her ability to apply her intelligence to her life, which is not something we generally celebrate in women, particularly in history, but actually something that I think is incredibly important. And so I really got into that. But it actually wasn't until I wrote the first in the trilogy, Just a Girl, and did one of my first ever events at Melbourne Writers' Festival with, as their young adult authors, novels, so-called. I mean, I don't care, anyone can read them. I think young adult just now means there's no actual sex in the book. I think Jane Eyre would be young adult now. And so it was for high school students, and there was a very little girl in the front, maybe she was 11 or 12, and she actually gave me the complete insight into why I'd always been obsessed with Elizabeth I, and I'd never thought of it before, and it was so wonderful when she said it, and it all just fell into place. She put her hand up and she said, "Did you realise when you wrote Just a Girl that you were rewriting the Cinderella myth?" And I looked at her and I went, "No, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And what I've always loved about Elizabeth I, and you've just helped me, thank you, to kind of understand it, is that in Cinderella and all those other fairy stories, the prince has to come and rescue the poor neglected girl. But Elizabeth grew up and became her own prince and rescued herself. And that's why I'm obsessed with her.
So how did you come to... I don't want to interrupt your applause. But how did you come to the decision to write in her voice?
Okay, because well, this is much less inspiring answer. And Lisa knows it because we were to do with her. Her fault. Because what happened was I was in this writing group and I was desperately trying to write something that someone would read and failing quite spectacularly to do so. The writing group, which Lisa was part of, were very, very tolerant of me. And Lisa was writing the book that eventually became The Wedding Shroud. And she would read this out and, it was terrific. And she got some interest. She was the first of us to get some interest from a literary agent. And, in the writing group I said, "Oh, that's marvellous, how wonderful for you, Lisa." And then I went away and thought, bugger it. That's really, really... annoying me. And then I thought, come on, Jane, put your marketing hat on. You want to get a novel published. What gets published? Genre novels. What genre could you write? And I thought, well, I can't do detective. I'm not clever enough for the plots. I couldn't do chick lit. I'd rather kill myself. I couldn't do romantic literature. I'd have to kill myself twice. Science fiction doesn't interest me. What could I do? And I went, historical. I like history. And then I thought, A lot of research in history. I know, I'll do Elizabeth I. I've read everything, I thought, till you actually get to write the book and then you find out how much you don't know. I've read everything, I'm really interested in her, and I just sat down and started writing, and it came out in her voice, in the first person. And I took it into the writing group, you know, the next time we were going, and I read out what I just blurted onto the page, and they all said, they all kind of sighed with relief that they didn't have to listen to the turgid nonsense I'd been imposing on them up till then, and said, that's the best thing you've ever written. It was a low bar. And we want to hear more. And that's how. And it just came out in her voice. It just came out in her voice.
Did you feel that she was sitting on your shoulder, looking over your shoulder?
as I researched her, I felt I got to know her really well, but I'm not delusional enough to think that the person in my books is her. It's my interpretation of her. I see it in the same way as I think an actor who plays Jean or Elizabeth must approach it. You think to yourself, well, here is a human, because people always look at these women, particularly, not as real people, but as kind of icons of something, representative of something, because they were real people. They were real. They had fears and vulnerabilities and, you know, selfishness and stupidity like anyone else. And so I thought, what I really am interested in is what would it have felt like to be her? And that's really what an actor does. They say, okay, how would you react if this happened to you? And that's what they do. They represent the human occupying that particular role. They're not being that person. You really can't be that person as a unique individual. So that's how I approached it. What would it have felt like to be a real, vulnerable human being in this set of circumstances? And I hope I made it believable enough that people can also identify being Elizabeth or feeling like you're channeling
Elizabeth. Mm. So, Ali, when you're writing about Joan, you're giving us, as I mentioned earlier, sort of a multiple points of view. We get Joan's voice. We also get the contemporary voice sort of commenting, giving it, among other things, you get the most fantastically concise account of the Hundred Years' War in the space of about a paragraph and a half to set some of the scene. So you do get a wonderful sense of the context that Joan or Jeanne is living in when you read Ali's work. But how did you feel about representing Jeanne on the page?
Yeah, well, I did try at one point writing something in the first person entirely, And I think, you know, it sort of worked. There was a plot there and so on, but I felt that it was the wrong person. It took me a long time to decide what kind of person she was, her personality, her traits. I think partly exactly that problem of her being such an icon, that these icons tend to be flat. They're cardboard images. They're not 3D. That's why villains, either in historical fiction or in the world of Marvel and DC, are much better, because they're rounded. We know they're... You know, we know they can get angry and horrible as well as strong. Whereas with these figures, especially, you know, these sort of iconic heroic women, they must be strong and perfect and infallible. And that's really the most dreadful kind of historical protagonist. So it took me a long time to understand that her personality did not lend itself to a first-person narration in the case of her, because I kind of came to understand her as a very quiet and, you know, silent and strong type. She was a woman of very few words. She was often surrounded by her social betters, so she felt anxious. She was illiterate, surrounded by these, you know, highly educated, you know, courtly men and women. And she was a soldier. She could be extremely aggressive. She had a, you know, didn't hesitate to take lives. She was a medieval soldier. So for that, she had the kind of aggression that she had to often keep bottled up. We get instances of her just exploding with rage. You know, and so I felt that she must be quite shy, bit of an introvert. And then I thought, well, someone with those characteristics would not tell an entire story in the first person. So when it came to statements that I needed to make in her voice, it was almost as if she's very reluctantly using the shortest, fewest words possible to express something. And I left the rest up to the, you know, third person narrator and things like that.
Interesting about Elizabeth, just when you were talking about done, being a soldier and, you know, prepared to take lives and very aggressive. Elizabeth being kind of a few steps back, despite the Armada speech and the breastplate and all of that, was in fact considered in her period as being squeamish about executing people. And indeed, when she executed the first noble person in her reign, the scaffold had to be rebuilt because it had rotted from lack of use, and it was 13 years. And her sister Mary, obviously, was Bloody Mary, you know, it was constant, and Henry VIII is, you know, famous throughout history for the shedding of blood. So Elizabeth was actually a sort of odd flip to Jeanne, quite prepared to speak and talk about herself and make statements and write poems, very personal poems, you know, all that kind of thing. She did kind of communicate in ways unusual, actually, for someone in her position at the time. But when it came to the actual taking of blood, she was extremely reluctant. And with Mary, Queen of Scots, which is what the second book is about, she literally had a walking nervous breakdown once she found out that Mary had been executed, because she signed the warrant for her execution, but she refused to sign the actual order to carry it out. And it was Cecil and Dudley and a couple of others who took it upon themselves. They said, "We've got the warrant. We don't need Elizabeth to sign it. We're sick of her prevaricating. We'll just go and chop a head off." And it was the age-old adage of better to ask forgiveness than permission. And so that's what they did. And she literally fell apart with the horror of what she had done. So it's a really interesting, because we think of her, the Irish certainly, with good reason, think she was an absolute devil. And she certainly didn't she didn't value the lives of ordinary people in the same way as she valued the lives of the nobility. But that was across the board in her time. And judging historical figures by our morality, I often have problems with that.
Yes, that's very much an attitude of the time, alas.
Yes, alas.
She was also, of course, and you write about this too, very reluctant to spend money on
she hated
warfare because it's very expensive. So there was a kind of thrifty housewife aspect to not wanting to go to war.
She also didn't like it because war was men's business, and she as a woman couldn't go and lead her troops into battle. She was very afraid of therefore delegating as a really pragmatic, this is scary, I need to be very, very careful about this, delegating generalship to somebody who was an aristocrat in her court, because if they got the loyalty of the troops from her, they could literally... So she was... There was lots of reasons why when everyone said, "Let's go to war with them," she'd go, "Ah! Hang up, you know, hold on, blokes. Not sure that's a good idea." She was very clear-eyed.
Yes. But that question of the relationship between the monarch and the people, I think, is a very pertinent one also in Jeanne's case. So, you know, her relationship with Charles VII, she seems very much to be the one in charge of that relationship. And he's just going, "Oh, whatever you think, Jeanne." She must have had enormous charisma to be able to convince him, think?
I mean, for one thing, you know, the more... sort of hard-nosed historians think they sniff a conspiracy. There's been quite a number of books, ranging from the utterly crazy ones that say she's actually the sister of the king, the bastard daughter of the Duke of Orléans, all the way to people saying, look, she's actually recruited by the king's very powerful mother-in-law, who's the most powerful person in French politics at the time, Yolande d'Anjou, and they say she actually handpicks this peasant woman to play the role of the maid of Lorraine. I don't think any of those are correct. The thing what actually sort of happens is that she, for her own personal reasons, overcoming extraordinary odds, approaches the king in this castle, which is very difficult to get to from her village in Lorraine, hence her cross-dressing, which in the first case is a pragmatic thing. She's trying to pretend to be a boy, but then she kind of gets there and she goes, "Actually, I like this." So she stays in the hose and the doublet. But I think that when she does eventually reach the king... the king decides to use her as the sort of mascot, as a virgin. She's young, from what we understand, attractive woman who's going to inspire the French soldiers to go and die for her. She'll say, "Look, you go and stand in front of them and say, go point them in that direction with your flag," and they will. And that is a pretty silly, short-sighted mission, except that then she proves that she's sort of like a military genius, which is quite ridiculous when you think about it. Obviously, when you mention the word genius, and I think one can use it, the problem for me is not a gendered problem, is that we don't know how to use the word before the 18th century. There is no such a thing as something like a military genius or something. But I've looked at her battles very closely, and I've visited the battlefields and that, and something really unusual does happen, which could only come from perhaps the imagination of a teenage peasant woman who doesn't know about the history of the warfare up to that point, who says, looks at the map and says, look, the English are there. Why are we taking them over there? Why don't we just go there? And they're like, come on, they've got longbows pointing at us. She said, yeah, not if we charge them really fast with our horses. Don't let them actually set up their longbows. Have you thought about that? And that's actually what happens. And that turns the tide of the Hundred Years' War and in effect changes history. I mean, today we're talking about Brexit and all this stuff that's happening against about that. The sense of the English isolation from the rest of Europe, and that begins with the Hundred Years' War. But the English believe that half of France at least belongs to them. And the French say, you know what, no. And it is Jean who says, that's not going to happen.
But that's immense physical courage that she's showing.
Yeah, well, she's a peasant woman, and she's probably obviously slaughtered animals herself. She's been beaten up. She's fallen off the horse many times. She's tough. I mean, a medieval peasant woman of her class, she's of a bit more privileged peasantry. They're not as squeamish. She's illiterate. She wouldn't be writing poetry. She's got a lot of disdain for intellectuals of her time. When she crosses paths with them, she can't tolerate them. She's fascinating.
And also, peasant women, all women, in that period of history, really up till about 150, 200 years ago, had to be unbelievably courageous.
Mm.
You could die in childbirth, and they did, in agony and horror, routinely. Mm. So probably far less risky, in fact, I bet statistically, to go and stand at the head of an army was to face giving birth.
Mm.
A frightening thought, but yes, the statistics would seem to bear it out.
I think
you've made the point elsewhere, Jane, that there's a reason why there's so many stepmothers in fairy tales. Prior to what mid,
and we discount the courage of all those women through all the history of the human race. Somebody on Twitter the other day said, it's men who fought and died for all your rights. I said, it's women who birthed them in the first place and risked hideous death over and over. Fuck off.
Which I guess brings us to the subject of virginity.
Very, very neatly done.
Because this was not only seen as something of a spiritual good that you were being pure, but, of course, it does get around all the messiness of not just relationships but the birthing chamber and the complications thereof. Now, with Elizabeth, there was immense pressure for her to marry, and many historical novelists and filmmakers have wanted Elizabeth to have a romantic affair or even have secret children. But you have been very firm about sticking to the facts.
Well, it annoys me that we have to see her in relationship to a man somehow. We have to get her in there with a bloke. And actually her entire life really is an example of what a woman could do when she didn't do that. But there's a number of reasons I think that Elizabeth I was definitely a virgin. The first is it's too risky for her not to be. There was no reliable contraception. She would have been ruined and quite probably killed had she had an illegitimate pregnancy. She was never alone. There was somebody sleeping in her bedroom for her whole life. If she had had sex with someone, it would have come out. No matter how much she was loved by her ladies, and she was, somebody would have told something to somebody, for sure. So that's pretty clear evidence. The other reason is she saw what happened to her sister when she married. She saw what happened to two of her stepmothers when they married. Three of her stepmothers, in fact, when they married. She saw her best friend die, basically of exhaustion, having given birth to six 15 children by the age of 44. You only have to be moderately intelligent to go, maybe not. And she, almost alone amongst women, particularly in Protestant England, where you could no longer go into a convent and be a nun, and I think one of the successes of the convent system was that women could actually opt out of this whole thing, but that was lost to Protestant women. But the other really important thing that I've never seen any historian or biographer even think about, and I think partly it's because most of them until recently have been men, is that before she was 3 years old, her father chopped her mother's head off. Might put you off the whole idea. And so I think she had the option. She also realised that she really stayed a marriage possibility until her late 40s. She was still playing this, will I, won't I, will I, won't I. She was the archetypal prick teaser, to be honest with you. She used male sexuality and desire, but also desire to share her power, desire to share her fortune and her fame to her own ends. And she was ruthless in the way that she did it. And I have to admit that I'm a very bad person. I take delight in her ruthlessness and the way she plays that game so brilliantly against the men themselves. But it wasn't unequivocal. There's a wonderful poem she wrote, which I put in full in A Queen, where she writes about how when she was young she would attract men and she would tell them, no, you know, I have no patience for you, off you go away. And now she writes it in her 50s, just after the last guy who might have married her, the Duke of Anjou, she's finally rejected him and he goes humiliated back to France. She writes this poem where she says, and now time has got to me and no one is importuning me anymore. And I cannot say, no, do not, you know, importune me no more. I have no. And there is this wonderful self-awareness of the recognition that she pushed it away, but she's lost something that she's never going to have. And that's one of the other things that attracts me to her, this extraordinary ability to see herself in a very clear-eyed fashion, which is rare in anyone and incredibly rare in a ruler.
Now, Ali, virginity is a very important part also of Jeanne's story of that she is the maid of Orléans. Mm. She's meant to be this a symbol of purity. But in your book, you've given her some temporal pleasure as well as spiritual pleasure.
She's not a virgin in my book. The question of virginity is highly political at that time and at other times. Especially when she has the claim that she's been visited by, you know, angels, that she has to be a virgin. But later, of course, that virginity by her enemies is interpreted as a sign of her pact with the devil. They say you are, that can be interpreted that way too, which is kind of bizarre. I don't know if she was a lesbian, frankly, but I think the signs are there. Some other historians have hinted at it. The reason I put that in my book is not because I want to make it salacious. I'm very prudish. I'm dreadful at writing sex scenes. I looked at the covers of some of the books in the foyer, and frankly, I had to run away. I can't do
you and me both.
What the Duke wants, I don't want to know, frankly. Yeah. Thank you very much. But in my story, I'm not being salacious or anything, but I felt that once I started to imagine her as a lesbian, and yes, I did do my research, lesbianism has always been there in history, a woman not long after her in Nuremberg, which is close to Lorraine, and was drowned for that. So there's clearly enough of it around to make it a social taboo. It's not just confined to convents. She's sort of like, and once I started to imagine her as that, the pieces of the puzzle fell into, I could not then picture her. And of course, her sense of fear and the voices, all of that came together for me. I did not do it to make this story unnecessarily sleazy or I've been told, oh, you're a male fantasist or whatever. Mm. I say, well, that may be the case, but not, you know, that's not what's being reflected here. And I certainly didn't do it to advocate an identity politics. The book happened to come out at a time where we're having the referendum here. I mean, I'm for equality marriage, but that is not why I wrote the book. It's obviously, you know, it's turned out to be a bit of an issue finding a translator in France.
Oh,
sadly,
really?
It's a bit unfortunate. I don't know if that's the case, but in France, there's a huge market for books on her. But not those people who read those books aren't necessarily the ones who are in favour of gay rights. And in Australia, too, it turns out to have been a problem. I mean, it surprised me, but apparently it is. So there it is. And, of course, then there are people who say, I have, as a straight man, I have no right to write about a gay woman. Fine. But so it's kind of, it's all of that is very interesting. But anyway, that brings us to the possibility that she had sex, but her hymen was not broken. And this is where the conversation gets a bit gynecological. I can go in that direction if you want me to. But they didn't have very, very precise methods for testing the hymens of the medieval people. Nevertheless, the crude methods they had determined that she was possibly did not have penetrative sex. But the oddest thing is that with all the horse riding, that the hymen didn't break, which brings people to the assumption that maybe she wasn't. And maybe this was all political propaganda vis-a-vis her virginity. I mean, I don't know, but you know.
I mean, one of the things that you've done with giving her a relationship in the book, and it's a compromised relationship in many ways, but it does point to her isolation. You do get a sense of her and of Elizabeth also being very alone in their endeavours in life. Elizabeth as a monarch has no peer. She may have some close friends, but there's no one who's really going to understand what she's doing. And similarly for Jeanne, she does have a woman who ends up making an extraordinary sacrifice.
So that actually happened. So one of the things that alerted me to a special, possibly a special relationship between her and another woman is this very minor historical figure called Pierron de Breton. She's a possibly woman around Jeanne's age, that is to say quite young, from Brittany, which is kind of neutral during the war, but she sides with the French, this female mystic. We know so little about her. What we do know is that she chooses to be burnt at the stake for Jeanne, at a crucial moment where Jeanne's enemy is trying to collect evidence that would incriminate Jeanne as a heretic. Pierron, the Breton, says no. And there's a very famous sentence. It's in the records of the Pierron's own trial, which, you know, I had to kind of get my hands or see a facsimile of it in medieval French. And then she says, yes, Jeanne is a good woman. All that she has done has been according to God, and she's innocent. And by saying that, Pierron sentences herself to be burnt at the stake. So that to me is like, whoa, that's pretty amazing. Why would anyone do that? And when I kind of mapped Pierron's movements, the best that I could, you know, with a map of France, literally, against map of Jeanne's movements, there's enough correspondences for me to think there's that possibility there. One day, hopefully, when the book, if and when it's translated into French, I would like to know what historians think about this absurd possibility, if there is something to it.
Have there been any historians putting forward a theory as to why Pierron did what she
religious
did?
Religious fanatic, or possibly, basically somebody who's got a martyrdom complex, but we don't know enough about her. Or hardly anything at all. Mm-hmm. So I've had to sort of like construct her, say, well, as a Breton woman, where would she have been born, etc. That's one of the pleasures of writing historical fiction, to use these gaps and to fill them in a realistic way. But on the other hand, I do have a thing about, you know, the integrity of these people. Like,
yes.
I have a real sense that I can't just use them for its own good, for its own thing. And one of my real concerns is if, you know, the real Jeanne was not a lesbian and she was a devout Catholic, if she was around, would she be offended today? And frankly, I don't think she would be, because I have really, I've championed her in a way that she would want to be championed. She would probably today want to be remembered as a really brave and unbeatable military leader. That's my impression, and that's what I've presented in the book.
It's certainly a far cry from those sort of theorists. I was talking to someone some weeks ago saying I was going to be meeting both of you and these were the books we were discussing, and Joan of Arc. Oh, yes, well, of course, she was schizophrenic, which seems to be quite a common
view. But of course, the way people thought about religion and hearing voices and so forth, yeah, I can walk down the street in Sydney and I can hear people talking to themselves and I know they're not well. But that's quite
most
different
of they're on the
to.
Phone.
And some of them are on the phone, but not all of them, alas. pardon me. But in medieval times or early modern times, it wasn't the automatic assumption that it is today. But
it was so risky because it's interesting to me that one of the most enthusiastic of the witch hunters during that period, we're both writing in where there was three or four centuries long pogrom against women, which was all about witches, was James I, who is, of course, Mary Queen of Scots' son, who inherited Elizabeth's throne. And it doesn't take a great deal of psychological insight to draw a direct line to witches and witch hunting and wanting to establish yourself as king and put the world back to rights after this monstrous regiment of women who had happened to run the world for a short period of time. Post-Reformation. And, of course, if you hear voices and the whole thing about burnt at the stake and being married to the devil or pledging your virginity to the devil rather than God, this is all caught up with witchcraft. And for women, any kind of stepping outside the bounds of what was expected, acceptable, conventional behaviour ran this very real risk of being accused of being a witch. And being accused of being a witch is an impossible situation because you cannot deny, and there's no convincing way of denying something that's patently, obviously nonsense anyway. But hearing voices was a high-risk strategy in that particular period, like to admit to it because of the possibility of being told you're a witch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for that, in the John's immediate context, it could also be very useful because you could say, well, God has spoke to me and I've heard God. So it can go either way, being a prophet or a prophetess.
Depends on whether who benefits from your prophecy.
Exactly. So it's very politicized. Everyone can exploit it. You know, there's no shortage of mystics, as you know, in any political thing to do. They drag them out and say, well, you know, God told this mystic that I must rule the nation, and then that mystic, the rival would catch that mystic and kill the mystic. Then all the kind of all those things. But I think, yeah, mental illness is something which doesn't enter the question with Jeanne d'Arc. Not because, you know, I'm against it. No, I have my own issues, believe you me. But the question is that, you know, for someone to act with the kind of lucidity that she acts as a military commander, the way she acts kind of rules out a lot of the things. Obviously, as a modern atheist writer, I was initially going, yeah, I can do a wonderful story about schizophrenia. I tried all of those things. The latest medical theory is epilepsy, and that doesn't work either. If she had epilepsy, it would have to be such an insanely rare kind of epilepsy that doesn't have seizures and so on and so forth.
You should be
that does
off
have
the
horse. Auditory and visual hallucinations. We can just rule that out. So it's possible that she's just heard voices in a metaphorical sense, but in a real metaphorical sense. But I do have them in my book. I mean, at this point, as an atheist, I just give up and say, you know what, you heard them, fine. If she believed it, that's fine by me. It gives me opportunity to, you know, put some poetry in the book.
The really interesting thing about both these women, too, is they're both archetypal outsiders.
Mm.
And to be a woman is to be an outsider, particularly if you're wielding power at that time. And it's something I've thought for a long time, that the best leaders often are outsiders because they see things more clearly than those who are very close to the action. One of the problems with the Western world at the moment is we're led by insiders.
Mm. But among the many criticisms that Elizabeth copped, she was never accused of witchcraft, was she?
Not directly, and certainly not in England. Mm. That would have been very dangerous. Mm. But certainly she was a heretic in Mary Tudor's reign, and, of course, did go into the Tower, did face the very real threat of being executed and certainly thought that that would happen to her. She was quite reasonably terrified of it. Once she was queen, she was terrified of assassination. When she was a princess, when her father was alive, I don't think she thought she'd get killed, but she was terrified she'd be married off. So she spent all her time being ill and unable to go to the court just so that she couldn't possibly be married off to anybody. Then when her sister took the throne, she was terrified literally of execution, and that would have been for heresy and as a traitor. They kept trying to find evidence that she had plotted because there was lots of Protestants. You know, England was going Protestant, Catholic, you know, back and forth at that time. So there was that. And then during her reign, well, no, she was the absolute monarch. She was very, very powerful. Mm. So there were plots against her, again, as a heretic. But certainly people like the Pope, Catholic Europe, a lot of Catholic Europe thought that she was the devil. You know, that she was in league with the devil. They thought all Protestants were.
Mm.
But towards the end of her reign, even the Pope at the time said, she's a remark, like, she got this respect at this idea. And it's one of the things I really liked and why she was a hero of mine, was she was respected. That is very unusual for women to get respect, and yet it's a very powerful thing to have. And she got respect, and the Pope actually said, if only she and I had married, imagine the children we would have. Which is an extraordinary arrogant thing for someone to say, even for a Pope. But nevertheless, yes, witchcraft was part of the undercurrent, dangerous undercurrent that surrounded her. But she was so clever at holding on to two things, her own power, and she was a brilliant employer. So she hired brilliantly, and she treated her staff well, and once they were hired, they were never fired. Almost all of them died in office. And then she hired their children. So she had this real sense of family around her. And the other thing that she was a genius at was in holding the love of the English people. And the thing we forget is that the Tudor dynasty was in fact an ordinary commoners dynasty. They didn't really have much claim to royal blood. They were usurpers, and so in a way that perhaps someone who had centuries of royal blood would not have realised, she needed the ordinary people to be on her side. She saw what happened when her sister lost the loyalty of the ordinary people, and so she went on progress constantly. She did the king's...
the king's evil.
Evil, where yes. She washed the feet. She was in contact, got seen, in contact, as much as she possibly could. She knew that she had to be loved to survive.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.